This is episode 311 of That Shakespeare Life. Just like the work of William Shakespeare, That Shakespeare Life is made possible by listeners just like you who sign up to be our patrons. Patrons get insider access to the making of our show and special bonuses. Join us today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife and stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm Richard Shook, Professor of Drama at Queen's University Belfast in Northern Ireland. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend, Cassidy Cash.
If you look at the earlier plays, you're very often dealing with a clown. And then in the middle, it changes to being a fool. In around about 1599, suddenly we see the rise of these great fool parts.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
All total, Shakespeare includes 21 clowns and fools in his work. That frequency wasn't just personal preference about what Shakespeare wanted to write about, though. It was, as you may have guessed, a reflection of actual history. The fool as a figure in society dates all the way back to the Romans as an appointed member whose job it was to entertain with honesty, mockery, and behavior that would have been foolish for anyone else to try. Since it is April Fool's Day today, that makes it the perfect time to explore the history of fools, which is why we're meeting with Tim Fitzhyam, who is currently completing his PhD on Robert Armin, a man who is most famous for playing some of those clowns and fools you see in Shakespeare's plays. Tim joins us today to help us unpack the history behind the fools of Shakespeare, the real people from the 16th and 17th century who served as fools in the royal court for Shakespeare's lifetime, the life of Robert Armin, and the role that he had in developing Shakespeare's fools, as well as to share with us what we should know about 16th and 17th century history when it comes to clowns, jesters, and fools when we see them in Shakespeare's plays. Tim Fitzhyam is the Borough Council of King's Lynn and West Norfolk Creative Director, where he was appointed to oversee the revival of St. George's Guildhall in King's Lynn. You can find out more about Tim and links to the King's Lynn Guildhall in the show notes for today's episode. Hello, Tim. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life.
Hello. It's very exciting to see you. I'm speaking to you from backstage at the UK's oldest working theatre. I'm in a dressing room.
That's fantastic to have you coming to us from the inside the theater. How appropriate for our Shakespeare conversation today, especially since we're diving right onto the stage of Shakespeare's theater to look at some of his most exciting characters. At least they are to me. The fool is one of these recurrent characters in Shakespeare's plays, but the term itself was applied more broadly in Shakespeare's lifetime, and it included things that was known as a, quote, natural fool. And this stood in contrast to someone that was professionally employed to entertain people, but the word was the same in both instances. Tim, I was wondering if you would explain for us the definition of a natural fool and how that contrasted with the professional fool that we're talking about in terms of people like Robert Armin.
Well, it's interesting you ask about this. The first person really to define these things and write them down in that way is Robert Armin. So Armin is sort of the person that, in a way, comes up with in written texts the words artificial fool and natural fool. And by a natural fool, I guess Armin is talking about somebody who we would call has special educational needs. So somebody who perhaps has been born with some form of mental illness in some way, or a physical deformity that they might not be able to deal with. And so it would be somebody that now we would take a very different view of than perhaps in Robert Armin's time. In Armin's time, they didn't have a state pension, they didn't have a welfare system, they didn't have any of that stuff, really. It was just down to people to try and get through life. And natural fools were very often people that were able to make money from being themselves and being simple, you know, people with an educational need, let's say. So very often these natural fools were kept by very rich people who used them as a form of entertainment. And now, obviously now we would see that as a really, really bad thing to do. It would be not a nice way to look after those people. But in that period, it was seen as perfectly acceptable. And also it gave them some money in that way.
I read that it was kind of viewed as a form of charity because there weren't any, you know, public systems available for people that couldn't hold a job for a variety of reasons. If they couldn't work in the standard established places, this was considered kindness. That's how it was viewed. They weren't trying to they were, but they weren't trying to belittle or disparage someone. And in fact, in a lot of instances, they were viewed as people that needed special care.
Yeah, that's right. And we certainly have examples of that. Armin again writes about one of those examples, which is a man who was admitted to a school, which would normally be for people of quite a young age, but he's admitted to the school at the age of 20. Which is obviously significantly 10 years older than anyone else in the school. And he's admitted to the school really for the reason that he can't really cope on his own. And it's a way of the school at the time, Christ Hospital School, taking care of somebody who otherwise would have been in the real pickle. And at the school, he was able to deal with sort of simple jobs and assist in kind of simple tasks, you know, like litter picking, we would say, or you know, cleaning up after people, that sort of thing, a very simple job that he could take great pride in and that he was able to undertake without too much difficulty. Armin certainly writes about this character. He's called John, and he's part of Armin's kind of obsession with comedy and trying to work out why this person is so funny. Because, of course, as well as dealing with simple jobs like litter picking, he would make great speeches, this particular chap and or person, and he would try and say very erudite things. But, of course, they didn't quite come out right, and that would make the other people around him laugh. And Armin was obsessed with trying to work out how to replicate that. So how to become an artificial fool, in a way. So Armin was clearly not a natural fool, and neither was any of the other sort of famous ones that we know of. They were more artificial fools. And what they were doing was trying to work out why the natural fool was making people laugh and then take that and try and sort of replicate it and copy it and market it and get paid for it. But get paid for it as a professional person impersonating very often a natural fool.
In Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, Feste the Jester is described as being wise enough to play the fool. Were fools in plays and in performance considered silly, comedic figures that were intended to be laughed at? Or were they more like bearers of unexpected wisdom? Which one would you be expecting to hear from them when you saw them appear on stage?
Well, again, Feste is a really good example. And in Shakespeare's plays, if you look at the earlier plays, you're very often dealing with a clown. And then in the middle, it changes to being a fool. In around about 1599, suddenly we see the rise of these great fool parts. And it's a slightly different set of comedy. So prior to 1599, let's say, and you can pick a date around then, you've got the clown. You've got your kind of Dogberry or Bottom or Falstaff, a big, brash comedy part, possibly involving a bit of dancing around and making people laugh in that way. And I think Bottom and Falstaff fall into that kind of set of parts. Post 1599, you've got Feste or Tolicus, you've got the fool in King Lear, you've got all sorts of very complicated fool parts that are much more complicated. They're much more like a modern equivalent in our country of something like Blackadder. I don't know if that's an American reference that people get, but he's a much more scheming fool, let's call him. He's always got a plan. He's got a brilliant plan to make loads of money that somehow never quite works out. And that's kind of much more schemery, kind of complicated, clever fool, we might say, than the Bottom type fool in Midsummer Night's Dream, where it's just a big, brash comedy part. And what's very often seen as the case is that when Armin gets kind of promoted within the company to the leading comedic player, that's when we see the rise of these fool parts. And Armin writes a lot about the fact that natural fools are seen as very often being quite clever. They kind of speak the truth. They speak a kind of, almost God strips them of all of their worries about the real world and allows them to speak a universal truth. And there's sort of this theory going on that a fool can speak a universal truth because they are much cleverer than everybody else. And whether that's the natural fool, who Armin would probably say has been stripped of worldly restrictions, or it's the artificial fool who can very much speak truth to power, that's for people to debate. But certainly when we see the rise of Robert Armin, we see the rise of these complicated fools as opposed to the clowns, and we get this, I am a fool, but I am cleverer than everybody else. I'm just unfortunate in that I wasn't born a prince. That's sort of where Feste is going with his logic in a way.
Now, you've mentioned this, that scholars do debate this situation, and there is a debate about which came first in terms of this change in Shakespeare's style that you're talking about, whether it was Shakespeare wanting to take the fool character in a different direction and bringing on Armin to accomplish that, or if Robert Armin's arrival and his own personality style on stage might have inspired Shakespeare to take this traditional clown character in a new direction. But regardless of which came first, Robert Armin's era with the Lord Chamberlain's Men did usher in a new approach to the character of the fool, and we see that played out in Shakespeare's plays. And I would like for you to tell us, Tim, about the roles Armin played in Shakespeare's performances. I think we should also ask here whether or not Armin reprised any of the Will Kemp or Richard Tarleton roles, like Falstaff, for example. Would he ever recreate those roles that were originally written for someone else, or what made him distinct from Kemp and Tarleton?
That's right. Well, there's three main clowns in the period, or three main comedians in the period, the big comedians, four really, if you go back to the reign of Henry VIII. So you've got Will Sumner, and he's Henry VIII's fool, and he's very associated with Henry VIII, and he's a very famous comedian in the period, and he makes Henry VIII laugh. Cut to Elizabeth I, and you've got Richard Tarleton. And Tarleton takes over, really, where Will Sumner finishes. And Tarleton is a huge influence on comedy. And then you get Will Kemp, and then you get Robert Armin. And it's almost like they're passing the baton to each other in terms of their level of fame. We should say, you know, Will Kemp was a European star. He's the one of them, one of the four, that actually becomes pan-European famous. You know, he tours Europe, whereas the others, we don't have as much documentary evidence, and we certainly can't prove that they toured Europe, as far as I'm aware. Will Kemp, we can prove that he toured Europe. And that's probably because his kind of clowning, just going back to your question, was of a type that would really translate without language. He was able to dance and jig. We know he was a really famous Morris dancer. And his kind of falling over, clowning, jigging, wiggling around, bells and whistles and handkerchiefs going off, really translated across to Europe in a way that perhaps the more complicated verbal comedy of the fool and of Armin just didn't translate to Europe quite so much, because obviously there was a language barrier at the time. So I think that's the first sort of point to make in dealing with these four big clowns or fools in the period. And I think the second point to make is that then leads us in a direction with Shakespeare's work of working out who played which parts. First of all, it's made much easier for us when we're dealing with comedy parts, because we're looking for the funny parts. So we're not expecting somebody like Burbage to play a comedy part. So we don't pick up a play and go, which one's Burbage playing? And go, the funny guy, because Burbage is a great tragic actor, and we know that. So it's much easier for us when we're looking for a part for Will Kemp or Robert Armin in any of the Shakespeare plays to narrow it down and go, who's the funny guy? And then we can go, when's the play written? And we can also look at what type of parts they are. So if they are a Bottom, Falstaff, or a Dogberry, they're probably a Will Kemp part. The big, physically massive presence on stage that we think Will Kemp was, dominating the comedy, dominating the audience in that way that Falstaff dominates the Merry Wives of Windsor, for example. With Robert Armin, we think he's probably much smaller in stature. He's probably not a dancer, but he is, by his own words, a very famous singer. So we know Robert Armin could sing, and really well. And we know that people enjoyed listening to Armin as a singer. We also know that Armin's probably a bit shorter. And we also think that Armin is certainly famous for the latter part of Shakespeare's career. We know that Will Kemp famously fell out with Shakespeare. He famously Morris danced from London to Norwich in 1599, 1600. And he doesn't really seem to appear in Shakespeare's company after that. So plays that are before around about 1598, 1599, we can say have Will Kempin, and plays after 1598, 99, probably don't, because he's left the company in a bit of a huff, and Morris danced to Norwich. And then Kemp actually sort of just disappears out of the historical document. We've got a very vague records of him touring in the West Country. We think he toured again in Europe, but then he sort of vanishes. He just does not really appear back in Shakespeare's company in the way that Robert Armin suddenly does. And there is a definite change in direction in the later plays, as you say, with these complicated, verbally dexterous fool parts. And they are definitely Robert Armin. Very often they have a singing aspect to them. Look at Autolycus in a play that we think was written around about 1611. Autolycus has got loads of songs all the way through it. And that is classic Armin, because again, Autolycus has got loads of jokes that rely on the fact that the performer is shorter. You know, the fact Autolycus changes costumes with another actor. If the other actor is tall, as we think he probably was, and Armin is short, suddenly it's really funny. If you've got somebody wandering around in an oversized shirt whose trousers are constantly falling down, you've got that added physical comedy that Autolycus can then give to the role if it's played by somebody short, which of course we think Armin was. And we think Armin was short because a lot of the words that are used to describe him are diminutive words, like he describes himself at one point as snuff, which is a tiny little thing in the period, or pink, which is a tiny little slit in a costume. So Armin uses words that are small to describe himself. He is called Robert, but he often calls himself Robin, which is a small bird. So there's lots of things to point to the fact Armin was short. In terms of the parts we think Armin played, we think the gravedigger in Hamlet, we think the porter in the Scottish play, we think Feste, we think Autolycus, we think the fool in Lear, those sorts of parts. We think he may have played Fluellen in Henry V, but that's also conjectured very often. There's a debate in The Tempest. Did he play Caliban? Did he play Trinculo? But certainly one of those two parts is an Armin part. Then there's an interesting category of parts, which are parts that we know that Will Kemp played in the early versions of the play. Instead of saying enter Dogberry, it says enter Will Kemp. So we're clear that by mistake, Shakespeare, or whoever's written that down for Shakespeare in terms of that particular version of the text, has left the stage direction in and then left Dogberry's lines in, which clearly indicates to us that Will Kemp said them. But we also know that Robert Armin played Dogberry. So we know that this is a role that was handed over from Kemp, and when Kemp left, was then taken on by Robert Armin. They didn't stop playing that play, so they definitely needed somebody to play Dogberry, and Armin clearly hadn't had a part in that play when it was first performed, and so is the natural choice to take on Dogberry, and Armin indeed tells us that he played Dogberry as well. So we've got several categories of parts. We've got those that are definitely played by Kemp, those that are definitely played by Armin, and those that are sort of inherited by Armin from originally being played by Kemp, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And it tracks with what we know about theater in terms of they don't just shut this play down because they don't have their clown or their fool anymore. They got a new one.
Yeah.
This next question was submitted by a patron of That Shakespeare Life named Michael. Michael, thank you for sending this in. He asks, we know that Richard Tarleton was a favorite of Queen Elizabeth, and we know that Robert Armin held a similar role, but was he also held in this similar favor? Did the monarch, either Elizabeth I or James I, because he's overlapping those two reigns there, but would they have held him in the same position of esteem?
Well, Tarleton is really interesting, isn't he? Because Tarleton comes before Kemp and before Armin, as we've said. And Tarleton actually became a master of fence. So Elizabeth I gave him that role at court. He had an official role, and he was also made a groom of the bedchamber. So Tarleton was given two really important roles in court by Elizabeth I. So clearly he was a favorite, and he was a favorite for making her laugh. He became a phenomenally wealthy man, Tarleton. And we know that from a court case that happened after his death. Tarleton's will leaves a certain amount of money. It leaves quite a bit of money, but nowhere near the amount of money that actually Tarleton was worth, according to the court documents that appear about 10, 15, 20 years after his death. It's his mother actually back in court arguing over the fact that the people that were meant to have guaranteed his wishes have failed, and she's trying to get that money for Tarleton's children. So I think Tarleton held a very special place, and he was there at a very special time in theatrical history, because Tarleton really is the first player to step out from needing patronage. He definitely had patronage, and he had, as we've said, two roles from Elizabeth I, but he was able to sell tickets on his own merits for the first time. And so he amassed this huge fortune. I mean, he bought property, he bought pubs, he bought all sorts of real estate that made him a genuinely wealthy person in his own time. And I think while Kemp, certainly, and Armin didn't achieve, as far as we're able to tell, quite the level that Tarleton did, some of that is due to circumstance. Tarleton was there in a period of Elizabeth I's life, and let's remember Tarleton died in 1588. Tarleton was there in a period of Elizabeth I's life where she was younger, she was more sort of out there and more entertaining and more excited about the world and more outward looking. And she wanted people to enjoy life. She was very, I imagine, at that period, personally invested in her company of players. When Armin comes to the fore, you're a decade later, you know, you're a whole 10 years further on in Elizabeth I's life, and she's coming towards the end of her reign. Armin comes to the fore in the mid to late 1590s, and Elizabeth I is dead, you know, a mere sort of 3, 4, 5 years later. So she's sort of winding down in many ways. And I think Armin was popular at court. We know by his own writing that he was popular at court. We know that he certainly knew courtiers. He certainly seems to exhibit a knowledge of those people that is, you know, pretty good, I would say. And he certainly was one of King James I's players. Armin tells us that he'd been requested to play his own work at court. But again, we don't have secondary evidence for that. So we don't have any secondary documentary evidence that Armin's plays were performed at court. But we know that Armin says that he was asked to perform them at court. So again, I think Armin is popular with the king. Armin is definitely one of the king's players, and he's part of that license that the king gives. He's named in that license. And so he's not made a groom of the bedchamber. He's not made a master of fence. But the whole situation of the playing company is slightly more formal. And so perhaps we shouldn't expect Armin to have been made a groom of the bedchamber or a master of fence. And perhaps we should see that not Armin was more or less important to the monarch than Tarleton, but just that the way that the monarch related to their players and to their comedians had slightly evolved by the period that Armin came to prominence. I think that's the way I'd look at it. But thanks for the question. It's really good.
Product of disruptive innovation, as they say.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right.
I want to look at the history of the real fool, specifically the court jester. We see these characters show up in Shakespeare's plays, but of course, the court jester was an actual position in the real royal courts. So when we see in King Lear, for example, the fool is the only character allowed to speak directly to the king and make statements that nobody else would be allowed to say. Tim, what can you tell us about the privileges of the real court jester? What did they have in the royal court that other people didn't? And were they given anything to visually denote their privilege?
That's a really good question. One thing we absolutely know is that the fool was given license to say what they wanted. And this is a sort of a tradition that goes back thousands of years. The earliest that we have this is in China, in fact, and it goes back to a jester called Twisty Pole. And Twisty Pole, the jester, was the jester of the Emperor of China when the Emperor of China decided that he wanted to lacquer the entire Great Wall of China. He wanted to have it lacquered so that it shone with the sun. And Twisty Pole stepped forward and said that he thought this was hilarious and that the emperor was the funniest man in China for this great joke of wanting to lacquer the entire thing, which would have been impossible. Now, of course, the emperor was actually serious, but Twisty Pole had turned it into a joke. And he clearly had highlighted to the emperor's satisfaction and to everyone else's, how insanely expensive it would have been to lacquer the entire Great Wall of China. And so we have right back thousands of years, the history of jesters, of court fools speaking truth to power and trying to flag up the insane or ludicrous ideas sometimes that kings have. Now, by the time we get to Shakespeare, it's a convention. But what's again interesting about Armin is that we've got Armin telling us about his early career, where Armin plays a court jester, but to a wealthy aristocrat. He's not the court jester to the king, and we do have documentary evidence about that, of course, and we've mentioned some of it earlier, but Armin is telling us about being the court jester to a wealthy aristocrat. So just as the king had a jester who would speak truth to the king, wealthy aristocrats also, it seems, had in-house jesters who would speak truth to them and try and mediate, let's say, in a humorous way between the lord and his people that he was commanding. And it goes right back, in a way, to the function of laughter. What is laughter for? Why can we laugh? What are we doing with that? And very often it's suggested by psychologists, the reason we laugh is to test boundaries. So very often we're trying to work out where society is comfortable. Where's the edge? What is the edge of what's acceptable? And if you look at a lot of comedy, that's what it's doing. It's trying to test where the edge is. Where do people get uncomfortable? People get uncomfortable when they stop laughing. When they're laughing, they're finding it acceptable and they're okay with it. It's when they stop laughing that you've found the edge. And it's a comedian that finds that edge. And that's really the function of laughter. And that's why, in a way, the fool is such a vital part of not only medieval society, but some would say it's probably quite an important part of society today as well. But that's the function that these fools are undertaking. And going back thousands and thousands of years, they're finding the boundary for the state or for authority or for society in what's acceptable to the broadest possible set of people, I would say. It's interesting as well. You can see if you go to medieval halls, some of them in Europe, some of them in the UK, very often you see above the fireplace in the little stone carving of a fool above the fireplace. And what that's saying is it's the lord trying to say, or the person that's built the hall trying to say, you can speak freely here. You can speak truth here because I've got a jester on the wall. That's me in a coded way telling you it's okay to tell me the truth. Be honest with me because the jester speaks truth to power. That's a coded thing that we have in architecture. So it's that deeply rooted that we've even got it in buildings.
Now, you mentioned that several kings of England would have their own in-house court jester who is their personal yeah. person appointed to hold this role of speaking truth to power. I was wondering if you could tell us some of the names of these court jesters who were contemporary to Shakespeare or a little bit on either side.
Yeah, well, we've mentioned Will Sommer, and that's of course Henry VIII's fool. And Shakespeare writes about Will Sommer, of course, in the play Henry VIII, which is probably the last of the Shakespeare plays. And what's interesting about that is that Armin has, well, we've got Armin's will, so we can say with certainty that Armin has died by the time that Henry VIII goes on. And there's quite a moving section in Henry VIII where Shakespeare writes that you're not going to see Will Sommer because he's not here, even though you really wanted to see him. He's not going to be on stage. And that's clearly because Armin's died and Shakespeare's saying, I'm not going to write a fool part in this play because it's not going to be played by Armin, which is quite a sweet thing. And I think says quite a lot about the relationship between Shakespeare and Armin. So we've got Will Sommer. He's Henry VIII's fool, and that must have been a tough gig, I have to say, because Henry VIII, you know, you just have to look at the amount of beheading that went on, and being Henry VIII's fool must have been an incredibly high-stakes job. We do have an image of Will Sommer. It's in a Psalter, and we've got Henry VIII in his bedroom, and Will Sommer's in there as well, which is really nice. So we've got a vague little image of him in a painted form. We've, of course, got Tarleton, and everybody loves Tarleton. You know, this phenomenal man who turns out to really impress Elizabeth I. Again, tough gig. I think we'd have to say Elizabeth I, not an easy one to make laugh either. Very unpredictable, according to all the sources. And again, it must have been a high stakes live wire act trying to keep Elizabeth I laughing at court. We have in Scotland, we've got James I, and we've got Archie Armstrong as well, his fool. And James I actually had other fools as well that we're beginning to discover. And of course, than in the form of Armin and Kemp. You've got those two big comedic talents on stage who weren't linked to the royal household, but definitely are people that the monarchy is aware of. James I would probably have considered Armin to be one of his, I think James I had several fools, is probably a fair comment. We know that one of them was famous for having a lazy eye. That's in the documentary evidence. So he sort of had a gurn. He sort of used to gurn a lot on stage, which apparently used to be hilarious in terms of sort of wrap his face up into a sort of a snarling comedy look. There's a lot of visual comedy. But of course, we know that they often, in the earlier form, had a mariotte, a little stick that they would come on stage with that probably had a little version of their face in it. And Armin, of course, we think did have one of these. Armin's was called Timothy Truncheon, Sir Timothy Truncheon. And Armin dedicates one of his books to Sir Timothy Truncheon, or one of his works to Sir Timothy Truncheon. And again, you can see it in some of the Shakespeare parts, the witty fool parts, the kind of Fool in Lear and Feste and Touchstone, that there is the opportunity, if you were doing the role with a mariotte, a little stick with a little head on it, that you could do some of the lines talking to yourself, but talking to your crazy fake little head on a stick, dividing up the lines between you and the crazy fake head on a stick. And that's possibly what Armin was doing in those roles for Shakespeare.
What you're describing sounds a lot like a ventriloquist act with a puppet. Is that the image that we have here?
It's sort of partway between a ventriloquist act and partway between a double act, isn't it? It's just the double act is a tiny head on a stick instead of it being another person, which makes it almost in some ways more hilarious, because it's just completely mad by that stage. It's like you're sort of talking to yourself, but you're not talking to yourself in a way. But yes, I think that was part of the medieval fool's outfit. And then in terms of the costume of the medieval fool, you enter a minefield of academic argument. So did they wear the cockerel hat? Did they not? Did they wear, you know, a long robe, a short robe? Did they wear pantaloons? Did they not? There's as many opinions as there are academics on the subject, but it is a hotly debated topic, I think we'd say. We certainly do have woodcuts of some of these people. As I say, we've got images of Will Sommer. We've also got a woodcut of Will Kemp. Will Kemp in his Morris dancing outfit with bells on, you know, which is a sort of a pantaloon style trouser with bells on it, and then a very flamboyant jacket with a kind of extra double sleeve arms that he would have flicked around, very much like we would see a Morris dancer flicking around a handkerchief. With Robert Armin, we've got a woodcut of Armin. He's wearing a costume, so it's slightly more difficult with Armin because he's created by this stage character comedy. And he's showing himself in the woodcut in costume as one of his own characters. We do have a very tiny woodcut of, or a very tiny image of Richard Tarleton as well, playing a drum. But again, the costume is not specifically what we would think of as Jester with a kind of tricorn hat. But I think there's just a question of them standing out and being more colourful. I think that's where we're going with the costume. They're not looking plain in this period. We're not like, who's the funny guy? Oh, he's the one in the brown at the back, or the grey. They're not those guys. They're the ones wearing kind of colours that shouldn't go together, that are bright, that are eye-catching, that are obvious.
Between the bright colors and the dancing and the singing, I think the performance of the fool is a lot closer to what we'd think of as a circus performer in terms of not just flamboyance, but strength and agility as well. Would the performance of the fool on stage involve the character or the actor playing the character, rather, being good at things like acrobatics or juggling in addition to their comedy?
Well, I think so. I mean, there is evidence that these people were apprenticed. So there's evidence that Armin studied with Tarleton. So there's evidence that Tarleton handed on his skills to Robert Armin. And there's evidence that Armin took apprentices and that Armin tried to hand on his skills to the apprentices. Now, we know that Armin was a singer, and we know that Kemp was a jig maker. He was a dancer. We know that because Kemp registered a load of jigs with the Stationers' Company, who at the time were the people that controlled publishing. So we're very clear on that. We're clear that Tarleton was either A, very good at fencing with a sword, or be very bad at fencing with a sword, which is why Elizabeth I made him a master of fence. So it's definitely one of those two things. There's definitely a physical element to what these people are doing. And I think that we would expect them to be able to juggle, and we would expect them to be able to do some form of circus skills. Yes, I think that's all part of what being a medieval fool was. You know, we know that they had this kind of set format that they adopted when they were trying to do their kind of solo performances. And I think some of it is very much rooted in juggling, and it's rooted in circus skills, and it's rooted in walking on your hands and all the kind of various acrobatical skills that we see today. It's about building up that stock of things that they could do that then allowed them to become a really popular famous fool or famous clown.
Now, you talked about Robert Armin having trained essentially to serve in this role. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about how he came to be working with Shakespeare's company in the first place. We know that Will Kemp sort of disappeared, but how did the whole Tarleton Armin handoff happen there?
We've got Armin for this. So again, there's no real secondary source material, but if we go with what Armin tells us about himself, which is a pretty good source, I'd say, then what we know is that Armin was born in King's Lynn, which is where I was born. It's where the UK's oldest working theatre is, as we discussed last time. And Armin then went from King's Lynn to London. He got one of the best apprenticeships in the country at the time. He became an apprentice goldsmith to the leading goldsmith in the country, the goldsmith that controlled the currency. He was the man that made the coins that made Elizabeth I's government work. So Armin was his apprentice. So could not have really got a better apprenticeship. And then we're told by Armin that he essentially bumps into Tarleton in a pub. That's basically what happened. And we're told that Armin was already by that stage relatively well known among his peer group for being quite funny and quite good with verse. And we're told that Tarleton recognized that Armin was good with verse and that Armin was funny, that Armin then basically fell massively stage struck by Tarleton and sort of followed him around a bit like a puppy and tried to pick up as much of Tarleton's genius as Armin possibly could. We're also now beginning to realize just how famous Armin was before he worked with Shakespeare. So Armin became one of the top four or five ballad writers in London during the period. Before Shakespeare was famous, we've got Armin being famous. We've got Armin famous as a writer. So he becomes famous as a writer, but he becomes under the kind of thrall, under the spell of Tarleton, trying to pick up as much Tarleton tomfoolery on stage as possible while writing his ballads. But then Armin gets picked up by an aristocrat. So Tarleton dies. Armin seems to, by this stage, have stopped being a goldsmith's apprentice somehow, and he gets picked up by an aristocrat to come and be the kind of in-house fool of the aristocrat. And we've got various bits of Armin that tell us about him touring around with the Chandos players, trying to make people laugh, and also trying to make Chandos laugh, Lord Chandos laugh. So Armin's in-house, trying to make Chandos laugh. He's also touring the country, making other people laugh. He's very good at describing his touring life, which is really interesting for people that like studying that period of drama, because playing companies are turning up in random locations, and Armin tells us all about it. He tells us how it is to turn up in those locations, how it is to be a player, how plays work, what you do, where you get changed, how many times a day you perform. All of that stuff is in Armin's writing. And then Armin, you know, still continues to be a writer. He still continues to be famous as a writer. He's so famous as a writer by this stage, not only top four in London or top five in London, he's asked to write the kind of what we call dedicatory epistles for other people's writing. So if you've got a writer who's not very popular or not very famous, what publishers of the time would do is they'd stick a short piece of writing on the front of the not very popular writer's work by somebody who was popular in order to sell way more copies of that work. And Armin is the person they turn to get him to write that dedicatory epistle. So again, he's a really popular writer by that stage. So by the time Armin hits Shakespeare's company, you've got someone who is A, pretty well educated, because we know that Armin could read Italian. So that tells us that he was educated to a relatively high standard in England at the time. We've got someone who is already famous in his own right as a writer and has a following as a writer. And we've got someone who's already famous as a comedian because he's working for one of the most highly regarded aristocrats in the country and making him laugh. And more importantly, he stays in touch with that aristocrat's wife. So again, Armin is kind of really, clearly they were very fond of Armin. So he joined Shakespeare's company as already a very famous, very complete unit. He's got his own songs. He's got his own material. He can write ballads. He's clearly got a following that follows him to Shakespeare's plays. And it seems that at that point, Shakespeare is quite lucky to hook in Armin and hook in Kemp, because these things are big sellers. What Shakespeare's genius is in some ways at that period, I think, is that Shakespeare knows exactly what sells tickets. He can see that Armin sells tickets. He can see that Kemp sells tickets. And he suddenly goes, right, I'm going to hang with those guys. I'm going to get them in my company. And you would have to say that Armin and Shakespeare must have got on. They must have got on quite well, because from the second Armin joins that company, there's no break in Armin's membership of that company in terms of all the documents we have. And there's no break in that company and between Armin and Shakespeare until Armin dies. That's what breaks it. And as we said earlier, there's quite a moving, I would say, bit in Henry VIII, where it's almost like Shakespeare saying goodbye to someone, I think you'd have to say, who was his friend in Robert Armin. Not bad for someone born on the high street in King's Lynn.
At this point, you have abundant reason to want to read Armin's writing for how much value Tim has showed us is in there. So, of course, we will link to that along with Tim's research into Armin and Tim's writing on this history, which is wonderful to check out, all in the show notes for today's episode. So stay tuned for the URL for where to find all of those. Tim, as the expert on Robert Armin, we would love your advice on where to start when we want to explore the history, not only of Robert Armin himself, but the entire role of fools in history and in Shakespeare's works. What are some of your favorite books or resources you can recommend we use to learn more?
I would say, and it's publicly available because it's way out of copyright, but Armin's work, Fool Upon Fool, is a really good read. He writes down six fools and he tells stories about them. Two of them are royal jesters, four of them are domestic jesters or domestic fools. And it's just a really interesting window into six fools from around 1600. And Armin himself is a very good writer in terms of some of his bits are still funny. Some of it's obviously a bit dated. I'm not going to lie to you. It's 400 years old, but a lot of it still holds up and you can kind of look at it and read it and enjoy it for what it is. So I, of all books, I go back to Armin and I have a look at Fool Upon Fool.
We will definitely link to this as something you should check out in the show notes for today's episode. Tim, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible, so your choice would be in addition to those.
Wow, what would I take on a desert island? I mean, that's a really, really good question. I do like, there's an American book called Confederacy of Dunces, which I also really, really enjoy. And that's a very funny book. That would be right up there, I'd have to say. I mean, because we're talking about Armin, I probably should take some Armin with me, shouldn't I, really? I'd like to take the non-existent complete works of Robert Armin. That's a book that should be put together. Somebody should be doing that because it's he's really underrated, as is Kemp. Kemp's poem about Morris dancing to Norwich is another book that people should have a look at. He wrote a poem called The 9 Days Wonder. And again, that's Will Kemp, but it is really, really good. And it's a really interesting window onto a tiny weeny bit of weird social history that is this comedian deciding to Morris dance from London to Norwich in 9 days just because he doesn't get on well with Shakespeare.
On a dare, I think, essentially.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
For April Fool's Day, you have your own story of reenacting some foolery from the past. You tapped into your inner Will Kemp, I hear.
Yes, I should have said that earlier. I did actually recreate Will Kemp's Morris dance from London to Norwich. I went and did it. So I learned to Morris dance and I strapped on the bells and I did go from London to Norwich in 9 days.
Did you stop along the way?
I did it. I did. I stopped exactly where Kemp stopped all the way along. I have to say the route has changed quite dramatically. There is a video which people can have a look at as to how that went.
That's fantastic.
What the thing I didn't quite get is I did it in 9 days back to back. And obviously when you're Morris dancing, you're going like forward and then backwards and then forward and then backwards and then forward and then backwards. So it's 160 miles, like 200 kilometers forwards and 73 miles backwards to get from London to Norwich. So you're doing like don't know, 300K and in 9 days. And what I hadn't quite clocked is that Will Kemp did it in 9 days, spread over 3 months, whereas I did it in 9 days back to back. So I was
there
physically
was a detail that you might have,
one detail that I messed up, but it was I was very physically well. There's a I'll send you the photo of me at the end of the Norwich leg, literally. Yeah, it was painful. I'm not going to lie to you.
We will put these images and links in the show notes so you can see more of this. I'm just excited to know it's possible because I gave Will Kemp credit for totally making up stuff like this. But it's nice to know that he really did.
Yeah. What's really funny about it is that Kemp says, this is hilarious. And I was like, is it really though? And the thing is that there's genuinely nothing that I've ever seen that's made me laugh more than when I watch some of the footage back and you see me arriving in Norwich, barely able to move, in so much pain, and yet still trying to be the merry Morris dancer.
To be dancing.
And you can see me wincing with agony. And it is so funny. It's that comedy is all about contrast in a way. And it's that contrast between absolute pain and agony and merry caping, merry capers and chips.
It was the sitcom before they had one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a lovely bit of writing. You know, he says there's a town that he refers, that Kemp arrives at one point, and he arrives on a Friday night, and he says there's two large women beating and biting each other like blacksmiths battering an anvil. And it's just such an incredible description. You know, you could just imagine Falstaff saying that. You know, it's a really lovely bit of work by another comedian of the age. You know, they're very special men, and we don't really read them enough. We read a lot of Shakespeare, but we don't read a lot of Kemp or a lot of Armin.
I think it would be a great companion to understanding Shakespeare and this period of history, for sure, to explore what they have to say. So what's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
Well, I'm trying to finish my Armin research because a lot of what we talked about today is what I'm kind of trying to get through and get out there and be able to publish for people to read. I'm also trying to restore the UK's oldest working theatre, as you know, in King's Lynn in Norfolk. The website is www.stgeorgesguildhall.com. But always trying to get out and do some more projects in my own special way and do stuff. I still get to do my shows, which is always nice. In fact, I'm coming over to Washington next week, which would be very exciting as well. So that's all. It's all good. It's just a nice set of projects going on at the moment. I'm really excited about it. And I'm on Instagram. That's what I try and update people with @TimFitzHyam. So you can come and find me there. Happy April Fool's Day. I love it. It's my favorite day of the year. It's the day for comedians. Genuinely is, isn't it?
Absolutely. Sorry. It certainly is today. We're bringing it all for the fools today. And if you're trying to translate things like St. George and wondering whether or not to spell out Saint in that URL, fear not. We will have direct links to Tim's website and to his Instagram socials, which I encourage you to follow both places to keep up with the work, not only so that you can find out about the Robert Armin work when it gets published, but the research and history that's going on with the restoration at St. George's Guildhall is fascinating. So definitely follow there and check out the show notes for those links. And you can hear Tim FitzHyam talk to us about the restoration going on at St. George's Guildhall in another episode of That Shakespeare Life. And we'll place a link to that in the show notes for today as well. Tim FitzHyam, thank you so much for being here and helping us celebrate April Fool's Day in such a wonderful way. Of course, with history straight from the life of William Shakespeare. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much. Oh, I should say, of course, as well, that we've now found Armin's house in King's Lynn. So if people want to come and see the house and they're in the UK, in Norfolk, Armin's house is in King's Lynn on the High Street. And so you can come and find that as well, where he was born.
Well, now we're all going to go on a field trip. Thank you so much.
That's a pleasure.
Thank you. Find links to the resources mentioned in today's episode, along with more information about our guest and how you can follow Tim's work in the show notes for today's episode. You'll find this as well as links to that Will Kemp Morris dance and the photos that Tim was talking about, all packed into CassidyCash.com/episode311. That's CassidyCash.com/EP311. Now, if you'd like to see more visual history related to today's topic, including some of the portraits and woodcuts you hear Tim talk about of Will Kemp and Robert Armin and Richard Tarleton, as well as links to the digital copies of Armin's book, Fool Upon Fool, 16th and 17th century paintings depicting some of these court jesters and fools that we have talked about today, along with more information on the real people who played these fools for Shakespeare's lifetime, then use the Become a Patron button on our show notes page. That button expands a bunch of bonus content, including all of these visuals I've shared with you just now. If you are already a patron of our show, you'll be able to log in using that same button to expand not only today's extras, but all the bonus content for all of the episodes across our website. Explore all the research that went into today's show when you find that Become a Patron button at CassidyCash.com/episode311. Again, that URL is CassidyCash.com/EP311. That Shakespeare Life is made possible by listeners like you who sign up to support our work on Patreon. When you join us on Patreon, you get behind-the-scenes content, including detailed show notes, as well as access to over 150 additional episodes of our show not available on public listening platforms, along with video versions of our podcast, discounts on the art prints available in our shop, and special extras like ebooks and worksheets. If you're an educator in Shakespeare history using the podcast in your classroom, there's even a special section on Patreon just for you, offering a 35-week syllabus and coordinating classroom resources to go along with our show, and of course, they also go along with Shakespeare's plays. Find out more, explore all the extras at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That's patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Nahom. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.